Guardian Unlimited.
Welcome to Science Extra from Guardian Unlimited. I'm Alok Jha, and I'm in the pod with Science Weekly regulars James Randerson and Nell Bowes. It's been a year since we started these shows, so for our first anniversary, we thought that we should treat ourselves and all of you loyal listeners by getting to the bottom of some of the questions that have been bugging us all year. Why do people seem bent on intelligent design and creationism? Why is there so much argument still over climate change? Is religion a problem for science? And why does pseudoscience have such attraction? To answer some of these big, ongoing philosophical questions, we're very pleased to welcome the renowned philosopher and author, A.C. Grayling. Anthony, thanks so much for coming into the pod.
Great pleasure.
We'll begin with, I think, my favourite moment in the pod from the last 12 months. This is our very own Nell, arguing with the distinguished biologist Lewis Wolpert on where science stands with philosophers.
One thing that seems to get slightly lost in these discussions is that whether scientific methodology is, it's very clear how it works, and I don't think it is. I mean, there's a big debate in scientific in the philosophy of science about how you define science and whether, you know, refutation is a useful method. I wonder whether it's worth examining that before kind of glibly
Certainly
chopping
not.
It out.
No.
No? Why not?
Please keep away from the philosophy of science. No sensible scientist that I know pays the slightest attention to it. The way science works is that you look at the evidence, you look at your theories, you try to persuade your colleagues. It's a group activity. It's not a single person working on their own. And you move forward. And if people can show that things are wrong or right, it's quite a complicated process about which the philosophy of science teaches us nothing.
Nell, listening to that now, I feel sorry for you even now after that barrage. I hope you're okay. Anthony, you listening to that little clip from Lewis Wolpert, was he right to say that science can't learn anything from philosophers?
No, I think he's quite wrong about that. Lewis is an old friend of mine, and he's had a bee in his bonnet about this for a very long time. What he says about the practice of science is right. It is a public team activity, and it's important that it should be, because it's frightfully important that when people put forward ideas that they should be rigorously tested by others, and that there should be a domain into which scientific ideas go. They're not subjective. They're not the work of single individuals. So he's quite right about that, but he's quite wrong about the fact that the philosophy of science has had no influence. I mean, let's go back to the 17th century and look at the foundation of the Royal Society. The founding fathers of the Royal Society all cited Bacon, Francis Bacon, as a great influence on them. And Newton, who claimed famously, you know, I don't hypothesize, I accumulate data and then I superinduce a reflection on it, is specifically citing Bacon. Look, for example, at Sir John Eccles, the brain physiologist, who claims to have been very influenced by Popper. I think that there are lots of cases where scientists, when they reflect on their enterprise, have thought about philosophical discussions of methodology, of test, of the public nature of science, of the way that science changes. They've taken notice of it, and they do it because all the sciences, and especially the fundamental sciences, like, for example, theoretical physics, find themselves falling back into philosophy when they've reached the limit of what's currently known.
Well, we'll get back to theoretical physics later on in the interview, but do you think that science is the best way of discovering truth, or the only way of discovering truth?
I think it is the way of discovering truth. I mean, if you think about the etymology of the term science, scio scire, I mean, I know you were looking at your Latin grammar in the bath just last night. You remember this, scio scire, scivi scitum means to know, to discover, to find out. And the term science has been used throughout history as a generic term for inquiry, for trying to make some sense of this world we occupy. And the wonderful thing that happened in the 16th and 17th centuries is that ways of asking the right kinds of questions and ways of answering those questions, particularly by quantitative means and by observation, became the method of choice because it worked, because it really helped people to advance their thinking beyond the kind of Aristotelian model which says that the heart beats because it's got a pulsative faculty, or the nose smells because it's got an olfactory capacity. Instead, actually looking at and being disciplined by the hard facts of nature. So this is the way, accumulating insights into the world by means of testing, observing, experimenting, putting ideas out there for rigorous criticism and testing by others. This is the way that knowledge accumulates, that we find truth or converge on truth. And this is centrally and distinctively scientific method.
Now, let me bring you back into this. From what Anthony said, does that explain some of the things you were trying to get across in when you were talking to Lewis back in December?
it seems that, for example, Lewis Wolpert said that philosophy had nothing to do with it. And we've recently had people such as Lee Smolin on, who's been talking about not giving too much weight to theories that can't make predictions and things like that. And there's an awful lot of different theories on what you ought to be trying to do. And I wondered what your theory was.
I agree with the standard view in the philosophy of science, which is that in its best normal working, science is all about putting forward hypotheses. However those hypotheses were generated, it might be as in some famous cases that somebody's had a dream about something or whatever, but generally speaking, they come out of the problem situation in science. There are things we want to know more about, that there are problem areas in theories which are well attested and are being used at the moment. So there are these problem situations. So people investigate them. They put forward hypotheses. They devise experiments, and very often, by the way, with the most tremendous ingenuity. You know, some of the work that's done in science is so beautiful, really. And they test it, and if it doesn't work out, then they try again. They look at all the parameters. They look at the experimental conditions. They keep working away at it. When they've come to a certain point of confidence about whether they think they've got the right answer, they offer it out there for other people to try and replicate those experiments or to examine the data or to look at the methods that they've used. And it's a really astonishing enterprise because it is so cooperative and because so many good and well-trained minds, all of them anxious to make a contribution. Of course, you know, partly because they're interested in knowledge for its own sake, partly because they want to win the Nobel Prize or the commendation of their colleagues or tenure or something. But, you know, whatever the motivations are, they're all busily working away at this. And the result is the world around us today. I mean, if you want to look at the monument of science, you only have to look at the equipment in this room or, you know, whatever people are listening to this on, or the computers they use, or the light or the heat warms them and illuminates them. You know, it's an astonishing achievement, science, really. It's perhaps the greatest achievement that humankind has ever come up with.
So, to go back to something you said just now, does it matter if you can't test what it is that you're working on, or what constitutes testing what you're working on?
Well, the answer to the first part of that question is it matters very much, and this indeed is exactly what Lee Smolin is talking about in his book about string theory, because he points out that there are so many different possibilities there are so many different alternatives, but it's essential. Any such theory that is really going to stand up must make predictions, and they must be testable predictions. And I think Lee Smolin is quite right to be anxious about that.
Well, let's hear what Lee Smolin has to say about string theory. He came into the podcast a few weeks ago to talk about his book, The Trouble with Physics.
It makes no predictions whatsoever for experiment. And that's very bad, because the whole difference, as philosophers and historians have argued, between science and other ways of searching for truth, other traditions of searching for truth, is that in science we have a commitment to argue with each other based on what we can deduce rationally from evidence. And as a community, we agree only to be convinced of the truth of something when it's made a prediction, when that idea or hypothesis has led to a prediction which has been tested and hasn't failed.
Lee Smolin there, talking about string theory. Anthony, you mentioned why you thought string theory itself might have various problems, but why do we still consider that a science, whereas something like intelligent design isn't? Neither of them make predictions, really.
Well, in the case of string theory, as I said, it comes out of a very, very well-defined problem situation in science, the attempt to understand something. We know what we're looking at, and we know what things have to be respected. Of course, the ambition has to be, anybody working in these very, very theoretical reaches of physics is very anxious to try to find something that could be tested, some prediction. Mm. I mean, I'm sure that even those string theorists who are so struck by the elegance of the theory and its inclusiveness, and who say, oh, well, okay, maybe those facts about the theory make it unnecessary to have predictions, even they, I think, when push came to shove late at night in the pub, would say, yeah, but it would be great if we could predict something and we could subject it to test.
I love the idea of physicists talking about string theory in a pub. James, you've got a question.
Are we in a sort of state of limbo here, that because string theory comes out of science, we feel as if, you know, if we stick at it, maybe we'll get some predictions at some point? Whereas because intelligent design starts from the position of saying, well, we're hypothesizing a higher supernatural being and we want to look for evidence of that being, you know, it's immediately not scientific. Because intelligent design people say, well, you know, we make predictions which can be tested.
Well, the thing is that intelligent design has got a very bad pedigree. It comes out of an effort to try to shore up prejudices, but to shore up ancient beliefs based on ancient scriptures. So we know it comes from a direction with an intention, which is not intrinsically a very respectable one. Whereas in the case of science, when you look back across the history of science, you see science, like an amoeba, always pushing out, pseudopodia, okay? It's always pushing out strands which serve as suggestions, as possible ways forward. And then if they can't be tested, if the experimental verification of them isn't available, then they wither and die. And it may very well be that string theory is one of those pods which have been pushed out and is going to wither and die. I hope this pod doesn't wither and die, by the way. but that's the idea of that. But whereas in the case of intelligent design, you know, it is yet another reinvention of the effort made by people who want to believe that Fred made the universe. You know, this is I use that name instead of the usual word God because it illustrates a fact that the desire to have this explanatory closure. Mm. Okay, we've got a big puzzle. Where did the universe come from? How does it work? Why is it all so wonderful? Well, because Fred did it, as if that really answered anything at all. And if intelligent design, very elaborate, well-funded American endeavor to try to show that there is irreducible complexity in biology and this forces us to think that Fred must have done it, what you do by talking about Fred instead of God is to show that it's just a vacuous, cheap, quick attempt to end the discussion about it by providing a pseudo-explanation.
In your new collection of essays, Against All Gods, you argue that faith arguments shouldn't have a special place in the kind of national conversation, the national debate about all sorts of issues. But there are many people out there who subscribe to religion. So on a sort of democratic basis, one might argue, well, you know, their voice should be heard in the debate. Why do you think religion shouldn't have that special place?
Well, if we were being genuinely democratic here and we noted that 3% of the population go to Anglican Church of England services every week and they've got 26 bishops in the House of Lords, we should begin to wonder a bit about whether democracy shouldn't, you know, just lop them off altogether. Look, I think that the point is this, that the different churches and faith organizations, of course, have a right to put their point of view in the public square. There's no question about that at all. They are, all the churches, Church of England, Roman Catholic Church, the Muslim community, they are all of them special interest groups like trades unions and other NGOs and the Women's Institute and so on. They've all got a right to put their point of view. The problem is that the faith organizations arrogate a special kind of right to themselves. They've already got public money for their faith-based schools. They've got an over-representation in the House of Lords. They've got special protection of law against blasphemy and incitement to religious hatred. They want more exemptions from law. They want, in other words, to take up more of the oxygen in the public square than, say, the Women's Institute or trades unions and other bodies do. And that just seems to me to be completely unfair. I mean, they are a self-selected a set of minority interest groups. And this claim that they make on us to give them special attention and a special dispensation, special room, is no longer justified.
Anthony, one of your colleagues, Richard Dawkins, shares a lot of the similar views to you. I mean, in his latest book, The God Delusion, one of the chapters is actually titled Why There Almost Certainly Is No God. I mean, is it possible to use the tools of science to disprove the existence of God, or do you think we just shouldn't be bothering with that?
Well, Richard treats the God hypothesis as an hypothesis and one which is subject to test in the way that any hypothesis is. So he approaches it very much as a scientist might. For me, thinking as a philosopher with a special interest in the theory of knowledge and epistemology, the way to approach it is by thinking about rationality. What I'm just about to say is something that very often annoys and upsets people of faith. And it's not intended to. It's just meant to be plain speaking about this matter as follows, that the claim that there is a deity, a supernatural agency or sets of supernatural agencies, is as good or bad in connection with the traditional deities of the major religions as it is in connection with pixies or fairies. And once you recognize that fact, once claims or assertions are made about the existence of certain sorts of entities in the universe with certain powers and properties, then you can ask yourself, on what grounds is it rational even to suppose that there might be such a thing? So if you said to anybody, I mean, this is a point that Richard Dawkins makes as well, you said to anybody, look, you're an atheist, everybody is an atheist, about most of the gods and goddesses and angels and archangels and so on that have ever been mooted by any community in history. So why do you stick with one? I mean, since you've got rid of hundreds, why stop at one or two or three, depending upon what religion you happen to be subscribing to? And it's very difficult for people to give a reasonable answer.
Doesn't that assume that, say, you've gone through all of the different gods and decided for yourself that Jesus is the one for you, or Buddha, or whoever?
Well, firstly, may I rescue Buddha from that imputation? Buddhism, properly understood, is a philosophy, not a religion, especially Theravada Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism, of course, has imported all these local deities into it, and it's full of superstition. But serious Buddhism is a philosophy. No, I think anybody who claimed that they had thought seriously, does Ganesh exist, or does Aphrodite exist? Oh, no. Well, I think it's the god of the Judeo-Christian tradition who does. I think that's a very improbable story, since 99% of people are the religion they are because they happen to be born to the parents they were. It just comes down to something which is intrinsically arbitrary. It's a non-rational choice, mainly to do with upbringing and other psychological factors. But when you stand back and you look at it as a Martian might, for example, you seem to be being presented with the phenomenon of religious faith, which is best understood historically and sociologically and not on the basis of, let us say, science or epistemology or rationality.
Do you think that atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, for example, is regularly criticised as being a fundamentalist himself? Do you think that you can be an atheist fundamentalist? I mean, if you have no belief system in that respect, then there's nothing to be fundamentalist about, is there?
Firstly, one has to be amused by the fact that people whose the extreme wing of whose own belief system can be fundamental or fundamentalist. And it's a name that was chosen for themselves by people who said, we believe in the fundamentals of Christianity. This is back in the early 20th century. That they use this term as a term of abuse for people who oppose them, as if they've implicitly recognized the fact that it is a term of abuse. But no, atheism is the rejection of a particular kind of belief, which is why, by the way, many people who are, technically speaking, atheists in the sense that they don't believe in supernatural agencies would very much rather use a different expression. I use the expression naturalist. I mean, I'm not in the sense that I go picking flowers and things, but in the sense that I believe that the world is a natural realm governed by natural law. Because if you say I'm an atheist, you've already started an argument about there being gods or a god. And I put the point to people by saying, you might as well call yourself an a-fairyist or an a-gnomist because you don't believe in gnomes or fairies.
Can I sort of focus this down a bit into some of the things that have been happening in the last 6 months? A lot of the objections to stem cell research, getting stem cells out of discarded embryos, come from the religious groups, pro-life groups, for example. Why is it you think that religious groups feel they have greater claim to sort of morals than atheists do?
Well, I mean, this is a very, very good example, actually, because if you step back and you have a look at the whole point about stem cell research, which is to try to combat some of the most appalling diseases, illnesses that people can suffer. And so it's an endeavor towards the good. It's an endeavor towards trying to help people and to minimize suffering. And yet, people of a religious outlook who think that all life is God-given and that nobody can interfere with life or change it or end it or anything, that it's got to happen by what a non-religious person would call chance, but what they would call the direction of the deity, are focusing at quite the wrong end of the argument. Instead of thinking about the people who might be helped, instead of seeing this as the endeavor that we make as human beings to care for one another, they see it as interfering with something which their ancient scriptures tell them belong to the deity. And it's in that way that religious morality can, as it so often is, be perverse. And it's very, very hard to understand the mindset. You could say to a religious person, look, don't you think that if there were a deity and the deity had created us as we are, that is to say, with imagination and intelligence and the ability to conduct science, don't you think that by using that to help other people, we would be doing a good thing? But oh no, on the stem cell thing, as with so many other things, the religious person says, no, you mustn't interfere.
There's been a huge amount of debate, especially in the last few months, about climate change. I mean, of course, amongst scientists, this is something that isn't really debated as to whether it's happening anymore. But in the media and so on, it's something that it seems to be a big issue. But yet we still get lots of questions about, you know, evidence. People will interpret evidence in different ways. And if evidence is the ultimate sort of unit of science, if you like, you know, to tell you which way to go, and yet this is such a complex and specialized field. I mean, you have to be a glaciologist to understand glaciers and an atmospheric scientist to understand the atmosphere, and you can't understand each other. Mm. How do you have a global conversation about this where, in fact, everyone needs to understand almost everything?
Yeah, this is the problem. I mean, let's come at this a bit obliquely by looking at the contrast between mindsets which are scientific or which have enough of an insight into science to respect the best deliverances of science, which tend, of course, to be quite cautiously couched and to be probabilistic and so on the one hand.
Lots of error bars, you mean?
Yeah. And on the other hand, the utter certainties and convictions that people of a religious outlook very often have. And you notice something of an interesting contrast between these two ways of looking at the world. One reason why I imagine some people have a psychological need for faith is because it provides closure. It provides a neat story. There's a beginning and there's an end, and there's an explanation for everything, and everything has its place. And the thing about science is that it is full of conjecture. It's open-ended, open-textured. There are a lot of things that we don't understand, a lot of things that we're looking for. And when we do make a bit of progress, we sometimes, for every question we answer, there are two questions that we pose. And living with that open texture, that open-endedness, takes a certain kind of intellectual makeup, partly intellectual courage. From that point of view, you can see this contrast between wanting everything neat and packaged and all answered, and the one where there aren't very many answers. And then you can parlay that into this business about climate change. I mean, here we've got a consensus, a very considerable consensus among the experts that humankind is interfering with the biosphere and the climate, and that things are looking pretty bad. I mean, you know, it's over for the polar bears. It's already too late. There's already enough warming built into the system, but we're not going to be able to reverse it now. Although on other figures, there's optimism that if we did the right thing now, really got on with it, we would be able to avert a catastrophe. But there are huge vested interests. I mean, I'll give you one example, just one example. Why are we not rushing to turn all our motor vehicles into hybrids or into something that run on, you know, clean fuels? Well, just think of the hundreds of billions of dollars invested in petrol stations all over all countries, oil tankers, oil refineries, tens of thousands of staff extracting oil. You know, there is such an inertia in the economic system that to turn all that round is going to take massive reinvestment and a massive change. And so, of course, oil companies and others go to governments and they say to them, look, you know, you're going to cause a hell of a problem with the economy if we try and do this in a hurry, if we do that. And this is why there are so many voices, non-scientific ones, trying to put the argument, oh, well, it's not as serious as it seems, or maybe it's not happening at all, or maybe this is a natural cycle, and so on.
Do you think that those people believe that the stuff's happening, but because of their interests, they're modifying their own beliefs?
Do you know, once about 4 or 5 years ago, when the controversy over tobacco and the harm it does was at its height, and there was legislation coming in about the size of messages on cigarette packs, you know, tobacco kills and everything else, I remember seeing a tobacco grower in somewhere or other, I think it must have been in East Africa, with a cigarette in his hand saying, everybody's got it wrong. It's absolutely false that tobacco is bad for you. In fact, it's good for you. And then he took a big puff of his cigarette. Well, you know, there are people whose investment is so deep and great into whatever it is they're doing and making a living out of that they just don't want to believe the evidence, and they really do believe the other thing, and that's scary.
Nell, do you have a question?
Part of the way you talk about climate change makes it sound as if the scientific community is kind of speaking as one, and a lot of what you said earlier was about, having a community that are in tune and all agree, or having a good pedigree for a theory and all that kind of stuff. Do you ever think you overestimate how in tune the scientific community is? Doesn't it have schisms very much as the religious communities do?
Well, the hopeful part of an answer to that is that the number of scientific theories about in any aspect of science tend to be very, very far fewer than the practitioners of the science. So that shows that there is quite a lot of agreement. But also, of course, there is a certain amount of disagreement, which is very healthy, because what you want is people to be skeptical about things that have been put forward. And you want people to be challenged by the skepticism of their colleagues, which I think is a very good thing. In the case of the climate change debate, there are, of course, scientists, and one or two pretty respectable ones, who aren't quite sure whether what we're seeing is part of a natural cycle or something which has been speeded up by humankind's activity. But you also get people, I mean, for example, like James Lovelock, who really appall people when they say things like, well, let's go for nuclear energy and don't use biodegradable packaging, use, you know, unbiodegradable plastics because they don't harm the environment as much. And they say things that sound very counterintuitive in a way. And so you do get this debate going on. And the people who really want to be skeptical, the people who don't want us to believe that there's a problem and who want to keep their vested interests going, pounce on these debates and divisions and discussions, failing to recognize that they are part of good science, that there should be a conversation going on. But at the same time, of course, I mean, you know, think about most standard theory of the kind which is used to shoot rockets to Mars or to run our computers or, you know, development in medical science and technology, and you see that there is an enormous amount of agreement and consensus.
I just wanted to bring you back to something you said a moment ago about how science is sort of open-ended and messy, and whereas religion gives you this sort of closed and quite comforting view. I wonder if there's something in that in terms of why pseudoscience seems to be so prevalent and so popular at the moment, things like homeopathy and you know, crystal healing, that kind of stuff. Some of it has the look and feel kind of science and maybe is appealing because of that. But why do you think that those things are so appealing?
They all have one thing in common with one another and with religion, and that is that you can tell anybody the religious story or the homeopathic story or the crystal story in 10 minutes. But to get anybody to see the point of physics or of meteorology or something takes years of training. I mean, really, to get them to see it. And there is a big difference. Take, for example, astrology. If you look into it, you see that there are all sorts of theories of astrology. There's Indian astrology, there's Western astrology, and the different schools of astrology in both, lots of refinements and technicalities. And, you know, you can take a long time to train up to be an astrologer. But if you don't think that the visible heavenly bodies, the ones visible from Earth, actually determine your character and your fate, then there is no point whatever in going into all the different technical differences between all the different theories of astrology, other than sociologically or historically.
But and so in terms of sort of paraphrase your argument brutally, I'm sure it's all about people's kind of attention span, that people's attention span is so short that, you know, and you can explain a pseudoscientific idea in a seemingly intelligible way in 10 minutes or less, whereas, you know, you can't explain physics. Is that it, or is there more to it that's attractive about pseudoscience?
That is one very important part of it. Add to that, however, other needs that people have and misunderstandings that they make about those needs. So, for example, people think that unless you have a faith of some kind or unless there's a God, then there cannot be a moral law. That's a terrible mistake, a very, very deep mistake. I mean, most people who do or try to do good in this world or to live responsibly and attentively to other people and who do so without the promptings of religion, without believing that they're going to be rewarded or punished and so on, but they do it out of respect for their fellow men, are in many ways more admirable as moral agents than people who are doing it because they think that they've been commanded to do it or they'll get a reward if they do it.
I'm thinking more at the moment, leaving religion on one side at the moment, just I'm thinking more about kind of pseudoscience, okay. You know, things like homeopathy and, those kind of things.
Well, as I said, I mean, I think the parallel there is that they are also pretty easy to explain to people. I mean, all you have to do is to walk into one of these health food shops and browse along the shelves, and they've got all these different stuff. There's all this different stuff you can buy, and there's a little card attached to the shelf which tells you what it's for. And then that's it. You don't have to ask for the mechanism or the biochemistry of it or anything.
Oh, but hold on. There's a little card again alongside the paracetamol that says what it's for.
Now, arguing against that, though, surely with the paracetamol, you've got tons of contradictions, you know, side effects, all sorts of things attached to it, which I don't think you'd have with any homeopathic product or any sort of herbal remedy. It's much more sort of, again, back to the error bars. I mean, I think that's the... Sorry, I didn't mean to answer your question.
Answering it very, very eloquently indeed, yeah. It's a question of pedigree in these cases. You see, the one paracetamol comes out of pharmaceutical industry, which has done quite a lot of research on this stuff, and there have been clinical trials, and there have been government bodies that they've had to satisfy before they could market this stuff over the counter.
Anthony, we'll try and wind up fairly quickly now. The picture we've painted here is that there's been a corrosion of sort of reasonable activity almost over the last, well, maybe in the last century, even though science, as you've alluded to earlier, has produced all these wonderful things, everything we see around us in this studio, all the computers, all the other things, it's been a real testament to mankind's achievement. Yet we seem to be losing faith with science, or society seems to be. We distrust climate scientists, we distrust biologists who want to extract stem cells. What do you think is the answer to this? I mean, are you optimistic about the human race?
Well, firstly, yes, I am optimistic, as it happens, and I think the answer to the latter part of your question ties in with that very much. I think that there is a lot of volume attached to criticism of scientists who are trying to extract stem cells or who are warning us about the effects of global warming. There's a lot of volume in the criticism, but in fact, the argument that's put by responsible science does tend, on the whole, to carry the day. And by the way, we've neglected entirely here the question of the misapplications of science into weapons of mass destruction and so on, which is a downside of all this too. So that you know, adds a kind of a margin here that we shouldn't forget. But optimistic about it, because however loud the complainers are and the skeptics and the naysayers are from whatever direction, whether it's religious or not, I think the onward pressure of progress in understanding the world, in science and in the technological applications of science to the extent possible, is sort of irresistible in a way, because most people recognize, I mean, you know, even people of faith, when they're in an aeroplane, will rely on aerodynamics. And when they get sick and they get taken to hospital in an ambulance, they're going to rely on, you know, readings of their blood pressures and antibiotics and things. So the onward pressure of that positive kind of science is, it seems to me, irresistible. And finally, I think, again, if one takes a step back, it's so easy to drown in particularities of our own time. What we're seeing at the moment with a lot of noise from people who have a religious outlook and who contest a lot of the things that worry them in the development of society and science is a reprise of things that have happened several times before. In the 16th and 17th century, the fight put up by the church against the rise of science and against the Reformation and the liberty of conscience and thought that attended it was a very bitter and very bloody one. There was a very, very bitter, unhappy struggle in people themselves, in their consciences and in society after Darwin, after 1859. It's happening again now because the globalization of Western society and Western values has really upset people of a much more traditional outlook. For example, in the Muslim Middle East, they feel threatened by it. They feel anxious about it. They see cinema images of girls running around in bikinis, and they don't want their daughters to do that kind of thing. So you can sympathize and understand with the difficulties that people face. And what they do is they respond on the extreme margin with violence, but in the moderate margin with a lot of anxiety. This is just one of those pulses of history, and we shouldn't mistake it for anti-science or a turning back to the Dark Ages.
Well, I, for one, hope that you're absolutely right on all of that. Anthony, thank you so much for your time. You can hear more from Anthony at a debate on Tuesday, March 27th, at the Great Hall in Westminster. He'll be stepping up alongside Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens to argue we'd be better off without religion. You can also read more of his work in the new collection of essays called Against All Gods, published by Oberon Books. Remember, we'd love to hear anything you'd like to say on anything you've heard in the show. You can email us at science@guardian.co.uk or visit our new MySpace page at myspace.com/guardianscience. It just remains for me to thank James Randerson, Nell Bowes and our producer Phil Maynard for all the brilliant questions. And if you like what you heard, remember you can hear more from the Guardian's science and tech team in our weekly science podcast, available every Monday at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. And if you go there now, you can hear our first birthday show, where the pharmacologist David Nutt tells us the way we classify illegal drugs boxes in Britain is all wrong. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. Guardian Unlimited.